Today is April 24th, and we are Michael and Carrie Klein at the Concord Free Public Library, the boardroom. It's a beautiful day outside. It's 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And would you say my name is, please?
My name is Shirley Blanca.
One more time.
Shirley Blanca.
Okay. And we never ask people their birthday, but maybe you'd give us your... Or we never ask people their age. Maybe you'd give us your date of birth so we can put this in a historical perspective.
All right. The 2nd of December, 1934.
34, okay. And if you would, please start off. Tell us a little bit about your people and where you were raised.
All right. Well, I grew up in England, where I stayed until I was 24 years old. And, do you want to know about my educational background more or just general?
Whatever you want to tell me.
All right.
your educational background.
Okay, yeah. Well, I grew up on a farm, and but my father was a lawyer in London. So we were out of London during the Second World War because of the bombing. And so I really grew up in Bedfordshire, about 20 miles from where William Bulkley, who was one of the founders of Concord, came from. So I feel a certain connection with...
What sort of a place was that on the farm? What sort of community, what sort of place was it?
Well, there was a village nearby, but we were about a couple of miles away, so we were relatively isolated on the farm. And there was two local churches that dated from the, about the 14th century. And the one that was nearest to us was rebuilt in the 14th century. And it had some old brasses and things. And then about a couple of miles in the other direction, there were some earthworks which were extensive. They covered several acres, and there was one man-made hill about 50 feet high from which you could see the whole area all around, and nobody really knew what these things were. And my parents, being interested in history, brought me up with that. And I from childhood wanted to know what these things were, and that was kind of what steered me towards archaeology originally. So I ended up going to Cambridge University and specializing in archaeology and anthropology there. And I didn't get back to this earthwork, or at least knowing what it was, until probably just a few years ago. And I talked to the local archaeologist in the local town, Bedford, asked him if they knew what it was. And he said, well, we think it's medieval. So there were fish ponds, and there were what looked like bases of ramparts over a wide area. So, but just growing up surrounded by that kind of thing gives you an interest if you have that kind of bent at all. So, anyway, then having finished up at Cambridge and got my degree. I didn't really know what to do next. It wasn't, easy to go on with archaeology unless you were really at the top of the heap academically, which I wasn't. And there were very few jobs in archaeology, apart from that. And then I got the chance to go to Harvard Business School. So this was through the Cambridge placement office. So I said, okay, if they'll take me, I'll try anything once. So I came over here, and at that time, women weren't allowed to take the MBA. And so I was in a one-year program, which was at Radcliffe, combined with the business school. And my fellow classmates and I from that have just had our 50th anniversary, and we really didn't realize at the time to what extent we were making waves for the Harvard Business School, because the year afterwards they started to take women. And we could have gone, but, we'd made other plans mostly by then. So But as far as I'm concerned, yeah, I met my husband at the end of that time. I came back to England for a while, but we got engaged, and then a year later I was, you know, we were married, and I came back. And we were in the New York environs in New Jersey. And I had the chance to work as a volunteer at the American Museum of Natural History. And after about a year there, they gave me a job, which was very nice. And I was involved in making new exhibits for the Hall of Man in Africa at that museum. So I spent several years doing that.
Doing the research or building the exhibits?
Doing the research and working with the designer who built them, yeah. So I was doing, you know, part of the design aspect, but not actually building the things, yeah. So then, after a few years, my husband changed jobs when he came up here, and I worked for about a year as a research assistant at Harvard, and then I decided, that was for William Howells, who is a physical anthropologist, very charming man. But I decided I really wanted to see if I could get back into archaeology. And at that time, Harvard didn't take part-time students, so I went to Boston University, and I got my PhD there. And I needed to work part-time because I had two small children, and I couldn't see working full-time on a doctorate at Harvard. So that was that. And then that took me 10 years to get through that. And then... before that, I walked into the library here. I was looking for a research topic for my PhD, and I saw the library in the front hall there had a little artifact exhibit. So I said, where does this come from, you know, this material? And they said, oh, we've got barrels full of it down in the basement. So I said, well, could I take a look? And they said, yes. And I opened one of the barrels, and I stuck my hand in like this. And there were a lot of little, what archaeologists call projectile points, other people call them arrowheads, mixed together with small pieces of styrofoam. But anyway, what I pulled out in my hand was a Paleo-Indian point. You know, one of the very earliest kinds of points goes back to the Ice Age, or just after the Ice Age. So I thought to myself, I bet that's the only one in the whole collection, but now I have to look to find out. So they allowed me to work on this material, and that's what I did for my PhD. So that really got me into the local archaeology here, and I've been doing that really ever since.
Fascinating. I guess they hadn't a clue what was in this barrel.
No, they didn't have a clue. Well, they had somewhat of a clue, but you know, I asked people generally, how long do you think it was that the Native Americans were here before the founders of the town? And the typical answer was, oh, about 200 years. And I said, how about 10,000 or more? It was just also at that time that the Massachusetts Historical Commission was beginning to worry about collections that had been made by local people and what was going to happen to them, because the original collectors were dying off. The families often didn't know what to do with them, didn't know how valuable they were. And they wanted the Concord Museum to take this material. And so they asked me if I would talk to the Concord Museum and see if they would take it. And at that time, the curator really wasn't inclined to do so. He had the viewpoint that this was a museum about the settlers and the English culture, and that didn't mix with the Algonquians. And I thought to myself, this is, you know, kind of ironic that here I am with my English accent and I'm... taking the point of view of the Algonquins. Over time, the viewpoint changed, and eventually the museum curator, Dennis Fiore, who was very supportive and invited me and someone else to do an exhibit for the 350th anniversary of the town. And after that, they started to accept these collections. So I've really been working on them ever since. The interesting thing about them compared with many collections is that the men took it very seriously. It was started actually by Henry David Thoreau, but the men who followed him were even more serious than he was, because he did not record where he found his artifacts, which is a shame, right? But these other collectors wrote numbers on every single artifact and kept notebooks with where they found all these things. So it's loaded with information, but you need a computer to figure out really what you've got. And so that's what I'm doing. I'm identifying stuff and putting it on the computer so it can be sorted and figured out.
Had, in the course of your life here, have you done any field work, which is to say excavation of your own, or walking through plowed fields or whatever people do around?
Yes. I've done a little bit of field work, but really not since my PhD days. I dug three large fire pits, two of which may be Haas, but the third one, we're not quite sure what it is. And I published a preliminary report. This is back in 1978. And I've been waiting ever since for a friend of mine to look at the bones and the seeds and to see what else it was in the dirt there, okay? And so she's finally got to it. So we will be, I hope, publishing a final report on that. But I got some radiocarbon dates, which one was about 300 AD and the others two were 1000 AD. And this, it's sort of unusual. It's got some potsherds and so forth in it. Potsherds, little pieces of pot, you know. And so they're unusual items. The other thing I did was a survey. Let me see. Well, I suppose this is in the 90s. It was for the Sleepy Hollow Cemetery. They were expanding into an area next door. And they got a professional archaeological firm to do a survey, and they found some traces of features. That features are where the soil has been disturbed by human activity. And they found traces of that beneath the plow zone. But it wasn't enough for the town committees to be able to decide if they should preserve it or not. And I had been told by one of the collectors, Ben Smith, that that was a good area for collecting artifacts. And so I volunteered to do a more extended survey if I could get people to help me, which I did in the end. And we spent about three summers digging test pits in there and ended up finding a number of features. But the two most interesting was one was a fireplace dating to 4,500 years ago, which had a little trace of bone in there, so I think that it was a cooking fire. And the other one looks like it was probably a wigwam floor, or it may have been an open living floor that dated from anywhere between 1450 and 1500 AD. So, and that actually... my report on that's just come out, and this has just come out this week.
Oh, congratulations.
It's called Nantucket and Other Native Places, and it has a piece in here about the Indian planting fields at Concord. So, the Indian planting fields at Concord, all right? Because this was an area that traditionally was where the planting fields were when the settlers came. So,
So the settlers who came here found agriculture or traces of it?
Yes. Well, you know, they met a collection of native people who kind of handed the land over to them, and they seemed to be leaders who came from different areas, so one wasn't quite sure what was going on there, but some of them certainly lived in the immediate area, and in fact they wanted to share the land with the settlers who didn't want them, and so eventually they got kind of pushed further out in the direction of Littleton. So you know, it's a question of trying to recover all of this history that's on the ground or out of the ground, as distinct from the English writers, you know, of the 17th century who talked about it. So it gives you a different perspective on the whole thing. But interestingly, there's not very much from about the last 1,000 years of Native settlement, you know, up to 1635. So these little bits that I'm kind of digging into are of interest to archaeologists and hopefully other people, you know, if people can understand what it's about, which is another problem, you know, the archaeological language and so on. So anyway, I'm trying to do my little bit to extend Concord history backwards in time. Yeah.
Terrific.
Yeah. There was one thing that actually that Leslie Wilson asked me to say something about, right? So I might do that. She asked me how recent changes to the built and natural landscape have affected archaeological exploration. And I would say that really probably in the last 50 years, not too much that's really bad has happened because of the environmental laws and the fact that at least if you're using public money, you have to have an environmental impact statement, which also includes archaeology. So that if there is something found, then you know, a proper excavation has to be done. If it can't be saved, then at least it has to be investigated, which wasn't the case before that. And sadly, I always say most of the damage to Concord sites happened in the first half of the 20th century, before there were any laws of that kind. And in particular, there was a very interesting site which was under what is now the Emerson Hospital parking lot. It was a huge shell heap of freshwater mussels. And it has an interesting history because a number of people collected there, including Jeffries Wyman, who founded the Peabody Museum at Harvard. And I found that the first collection that he made came from that shell heap site. Right? Henry David Thoreau collected there and made a description of the profile, which provides important information because he could see potsherds, pieces of broken pottery falling out of the profile, and described it in detail, right? And if it hadn't been for that, we wouldn't have known for sure that there was any pottery there, you know, that there was a woodland component to it. So anyway, what I did, I should mention Ben Smith, who is a local collector, Benjamin L. Smith. His family is still here. And he also excavated a little bit there and made a collection which, very importantly, included shell and bone and turtle shell. So I got together with three research associates at Harvard, and they looked at the faunal material, and I looked at the archaeology. So we all wrote papers, and we were able to get a radiocarbon date, one at least, for the shell heap, which goes back 5,000 years. But what the archaeology tells you, the points, you know, arrowheads, projectile points, spearheads, really, is that it goes back probably to back to 8,000 years, right? They may not necessarily have been creating shell heap, but, you know, they were camping there over that period of time. And so we, you know, the Massachusetts Archaeological Society publishes a bulletin regularly. So anyway, we've got a whole volume to ourselves with that. This was in 1995. So
including, could you read the headings?
Yes.
Especially the ones you wrote.
All right. Well, the overall topic is for Clamshell Bluff, Concord, Massachusetts, which is the name of the general area. Then we've got, this is written by me, Concord Shell Heap and Field at Clamshell Bluff, Introduction and History. And then there's Clamshell Bluff Artifact Analyses. And then I, with one of the others who studied the shells, we did Clamshell Bluff Summary Notes. So, you know, there's pretty good coverage of what's left of that, you know. But, you know, if the environmental impact laws had been there, somebody could have done a real excavation of the whole thing before it disappeared. So, but, you know, at least we've got something. You can say that.
What do you mean disappeared?
Well, you know, the parking lot is there, and from what I can determine, the level of the ground was lowered by several feet, and the shell heap was on the top of the bluff, you know, by the river. So I think anything that was still there effectively got removed by the earth removal to put in the parking lot. And it has been tested out since then by professional archaeologists who couldn't find anything around. So, you know, I think it's gone.
What year was the parking lot constructed?
Well, it seems to me it was shortly before I moved here. I moved here in 1967. So I think it was shortly before that, you know, when I first heard about it. Yeah.
So that's certainly a tragic example of the impact of the built environment on,
yes,
on,
yeah,
archaeological resources.
Resource, yeah. Yeah. And another one is that there was an important site, I think, where the filter beds are. And, you know, people collected in that area. And this is overlooking the Great Meadows, which certainly would have been a prime area. And is, I will say, it still is a prime area. And I'm glad that the Bemis Farm is protected because that's on the other side of the river. And again, that whole area was covered with Native American finds. And there's a lot of material in the collections. And the farmer who is working the land is still finding things. And he said to me, should I pick them up? And I was, you know, kind of didn't quite know what to say because the Massachusetts Historical Commission tries to discourage people from doing this, from separating the artifacts from the land. But on the other hand, he's running into it on a daily basis. So I said, well, you know, maybe if you really plot where you find things with something like a GIS system, this will provide additional information to what we have. So I think he's doing that. So and he's found some interesting things. So including half of a slate, something that looks like a slate bayonet, which the other half of which was found probably 40 years ago, and is in a collection at the Massachusetts Archaeological Society in Middleborough. So,
have they put the two halves together?
Yeah, they put the two halves together and they fit. So, All right. And I guess as far as, well, she asked me too about, you know, natural effects to the landscape. I think probably the main one would be plowing, because that affects the sites down to about 2 feet. But you can still find things underneath that, maybe not a whole lot, but some. And if it hadn't been plowed, people wouldn't have known that those sites were there at all, because they were, you know, picked up from the plowed land. The artifacts were picked up from the plowed land. You know, it's, but in some ways it's a race against time, you know, because the building continues and there's no protection on private land. One hopes, I mean, I think that people are now much more aware of the importance of what they might have on their land and more, be more inclined to preserve it. But
one can't always be sure.
You can't always be sure, no. So, but I think this town really has been unusual in that, in the number of collectors that it's had. I would say that the two main, well, there are three main collections that the museum has. It's Benjamin Smith's, Adams Tolman, and Alfred Hosmer. And there are other, you know, smaller collections there. And then there's Charlie D, who has a collection that he made as a young boy. And I don't know if, I think he has contributed an oral history. I don't know if you did that one. But anyway, you know, he's been involved in that. And as I say, you know, these men put a lot of work into identifying where they found the things and numbering them.
So they had some at least minimal training in plotting?
No, I don't think they had any training at all.
Uh-huh.
But they were...
they had sense enough to do it.
And one of the frustrating things, though, is that some of the collections, which are maybe older than, say, the late 19th century or early 20th century, I can't trace. You know, I've got the numbers on there, and I can't find out anything about who the collectors were. And it did happen that people exchanged material with each other. So, but I've got one collection I haven't yet really worked on, which has a box of stuff that says, from a field near Thoreau's farm. So I'm assuming this is Victoria Road. And as far as I know, nobody else knows what kind of material came from that farm, right? So, you know, you keep running into things like this that make it exciting.
Yes.
At least if you have my kind of interest. So, yeah.
So what pictures can be painted from a barrel of points. Shards of pottery, old fire pits. What sense do you get of early life in the Concord area?
Okay, well, I have just in general kind of plotted where some of these different materials came from. The first thing I should say, though, is to explain that the projectile points, which are mostly spearheads or dart points, or at the very end of it, arrowheads, give you a kind of a rough chronology. The shape and the way that they were made changed through time. So even if you don't have any organic materials that allow you to make a radiocarbon date, you can get a rule of thumb idea of what the chronology was, okay? And so then, you know, if the sites have been recorded, as they have been in these notebooks, you can set out where these things were found in the landscape and start to get a picture of who was living where and when and what they were doing. And what you have is sort of at the end of the Ice Age, there's a very little bit of material. It looks like you have a few hunters sort of coming through probably and not spending very much time and then going on. But one of the interesting things about that period is that they carried or exchanged...
This is the best one, tell us.
This is wonderful. It doesn't need a siren.
One of the interesting things
about the Paleo-Indian period is that they used very fine materials, and in a way, their technology, their stone technology, was better than anything that came later. And those materials they carried or exchanged over very wide areas like northern Maine and the New York State area, cherts, which are very fine-grained stone. And you find these very characteristic kinds of stone all over the place, you know, all over southern New England. And there's, you know, so one of the things that's been fun for me is to kind of pinpoint some of this stuff and then show it to people who are really specialists in the period, which I'm not, and they say, oh, you know. So some of it has been published already. Then, you know, a bit later...
So this tells you that people were moving around, that there was trade, tell you?
Yes. They were moving over long distances, presumably... Well, in a north-south direction by water makes the most sense, but they were going east-west too, which, you know, presumably on foot. So, yes, you know, they were... Of course, the stone is the only thing that survives, and one can assume that they were exchanging other things besides stone, you know. So you've got... You do have trade going on. You don't find very many big settlement sites, so it looks like they were really traveling a lot, maybe sort of foraging from the land. And also the environment then was entirely different from what it is now. You've got more like a tundra environment, you know, a few trees and so on, but not... you know, very, very different. So, but the picture for that very early period is still quite hazy, and it's still being worked on. So it gets a little bit clearer when you get sort of later on, say, you know, around 9,000, 8,000 years ago, and you have people who really were settling here, and... Again, you know, it's not very easy to tell were people moving in. To some extent, I think they were. Or were the traditions developing out of what came earlier, right? And it isn't until you get to what we call the late archaic period, which is, you know, 6,000, 5,000 years ago, that... You get different traditions showing up at the same time, which rather looks like different sets of people were coming in from different areas and staying here, you know, settling here or moving through it. Or another possibility is, were the people who were here exchanging things with, you know, tribal peoples further away, which included their stone tools, right? And that kind of thing is very hard to pin down. You know, I'm still in the process of really identifying what the points are, what the other stone tools are. I mean, some of them are big woodworking tools like axes and adzes and gouges. There are all kinds of knives. There's something called an atl weight, which we think was attached to a spear thrower to make it more accurate. Stone ones of that were found.
To make it a stone attached to an atl
To make it more accurate and possibly to make it go, make the throw go further too. But then some people say, well, you know, some of these things look like they're ceremonial, and they could have been ceremonial items too. You know? So there's a problem always of interpretation of exactly what these things really are. I'm still at the point of doing basic data recording of, you know, physically sorting out the collections, which usually have been in a terrible state, you know, and, well, not always, but the Adams Tolman one was, and just sorting things out according to what site the artifacts came from, and then identifying what the artifacts are, and then putting it all on a computer. So, that I have felt was more worthwhile my spending my time on than doing field work, because there's typically you spend a lot of time in the field and don't come up with a whole lot of material. This is, you know, thousands of artifacts. And I think archaeologists are beginning to realize now how valuable these things are, because you don't find that much from the ground anymore. And so they're looking at these kinds of old collections and realizing, well, this tells us things that we otherwise wouldn't know.
Our only clue,
yeah. But it's a little sad to realize, you know, if this realization had come sooner, you know, that more could have been recovered than it's now possible to do. Yeah. I think that for the professional firms that do archaeological surveys before building happens, you know, they're finding interesting stuff too. So at least that part of it is in place. I don't know. Have I answered your question about what was happening? Well, people. No, I haven't. I sort of stopped in the middle. You have the settlers coming in the middle, what we call the middle archaic period, sort of 8,000, 7,000. Then you get a diversity of cultures a little bit later than that. That was when I was talking about. Did people come in from elsewhere? And then...
Do these cultures have names?
Well, they have archaeological names. And, it's not going to mean anything much. I mean, it'll mean something to other archaeologists. But like, say, the Brewerton types, which is... Brewerton is a name in New York State. The Susquehanna River is another area where things seem to have come from. And then there's the Small Point tradition, which seems to have developed here, right?
Brewerton is spelled?
B-R-E-W-E-R-T-O-N.
Brewerton, yes.
And... The
Small Point was here,
a lot of little quartz points, white quartz, which, is very different from some of the other material. And then a little bit later you get stone bowls, you know, things of this size made out of soapstone.
What size?
Yeah. Yes, I'm doing it with my hands. Well, they might be, 18 inches across, something like that.
Like a big salad bowl?
Yes.
Out of soapstone. Was that indigenous material?
Yes. And there are different places where it can be mined, I guess, or, you know, found on the from outcroppings, all right? And so that's another thing that people have done, is to plot where that material can be found. As with the other materials I was talking about, particularly with the Paleo-Indian, you know, where do all of these things come from? So that's a whole study in itself. All right, so then, you know, a little bit, sort of in the first millennium BC or before the Common Era, BCE, this is when you get the first introduction of pottery, at least in the New York area. It might have been a bit later here, but this is still, you know, what we're trying to figure out. And people also have been working on corn. When was corn introduced? And it's generally been thought of about 1,000 AD, 1,000 years in the Common Era. Actually, this book I was showing you, The Nantucket and Other Native Places, this has several papers in it on corn and the dating of corn, and I think the earliest they think now is the 12th century. So, you know, there's just a lot of research going on about these different things, and I feel like I'm still at a very basic level recording what was here. Yeah.
So you describe it as before the Common Era, and is there an equivalent term for the AD?
Yes, Common Era.
The common era
and before the Common Era, yes. And actually, there's going to be an exhibit on the Concord Shell Heap here at the library this summer, which I've helped put together, and in conjunction with an artist's rendering of shells, Christina Joyce is doing that, and she has drawn some shells from the area. So I'm glad to have the opportunity to, you know, to show something from the shell heap. And it's not, I don't mean to disparage the Concord Museum, because we've got a permanent exhibit there of sort of 17th century material and a little bit earlier, the people who would have met the pilgrims when they came over. But I'm still hoping that at some point we can get an exhibit, a permanent exhibit of earlier material, which is at the moment not there. We've had some temporary exhibits of that. So, yeah.
Sounds like there could almost be an archaeological museum.
Yeah, yes, it could probably.
Place is rich.
Probably what?
He said there could probably be an archaeological museum. it's difficult to display archaeological materials, because people are not used to looking at stone tools. They don't recognize what they're seeing. And so you really have to kind of point it out to people that these things have a shape and they have flakes that have been taken off them in a certain manner. You know, the things have a kind of a basic template. They've been made the same way over and over again. And unless you develop an eye for seeing that, you think, well, this is just another rock, you know. So, so I think one of the keys to showing it is to put several things together that are the same, so people can look from one to the next and say, yes, this is, I can see that that looks the same. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I think, let's see. Well, all right, one other thing I haven't touched on, and this had to do with when I was doing the survey for the cemetery, that one of the things that the town was concerned about was whether they might be disturbing Indian burials. So I was trying to look, you know, it's ironic again, you're looking for Indian burials where a cemetery is going to go, make sure they don't, get disturbed. Actually, I didn't find any. But in the various collectors' notebooks, they do say where Indian skeletons were found. And in one case, there was a house built on top of them. And I still have to identify just which house it is. I think I know. But there seems to have been an odd habit, and it wasn't just here. I've heard of this elsewhere, that people would give these bones they dug up to the library. And when I first moved here, I knew about this in the 60s, and I asked Marsha Moss, who is the archivist here, and she didn't know anything about this. So the note came from the 1930s, so I don't know whether I can find any library notes that might say about disposing of human bones, but so far, you know, nobody knows what happens to those. So, but all these things, you know, take time to chase up. You're on a trail through a lot of different places and people. So.
Those poor librarians must have really had their hands full. Those poor librarians back in
yes,
that time must have really
they had
their hands
full. Yeah, I think so.
From human bones to
yes, anything anybody wanted to collect, perhaps. Yes.
But you were saying it's really kind of a race against time to try to track it all down yourself.
Yes, yes. And so, you know, the feeling I have is that I need to concentrate on getting these collections on the computer, because I have a lot of information in my head that nobody else knows at this point. So if something happens to me, which it could easily at the age that I am, you know, that it would be hard for somebody to pick that up again, although they could. But, you know, at this point I have 30 years of experience dealing with this in my head. So that's my primary goal. So some of these other things, like where are the bones, are not quite so high on the list of priorities. Yeah. But at the present time, the Drinking Gourd Project is about to move what was, I think, an African-American house to the parking lot near the old North Bridge. And behind that area was where some burials were found. So that does need to be tested out, and it will be tested out too. You know, so...
Before they can move that house?
Yes, yeah. And the lady who is the director of that got in touch with me, and they wanted me to do the excavation, and I said, well, really, at this point, I'm not doing that kind of active digging, so they need to get somebody from one of the professional companies that does this to undertake it. I said, I'll provide information, but I'm not going to do the work for that. So, yeah.
Is there a difference in the findings that a professional firm would come up with rather than an independent archaeologist?
Probably not. It depends on how much time they spend, you know, and of course money is always a factor there. But they would get in touch with me, and I will tell them what I know about it, so they will have that as a background. Yeah.
Who are the collectors of this era? Has anyone picked up the torch?
Yes, although, as I say, we're trying to discourage it. But one of them is the man that I mentioned, who's working the Bemis Farm land. So I don't think I want to identify who it is. But he has promised that he will give his collection to the museum. And I have really asked him to make sure that he records where these things came from.
The farmer you were talking about.
The farmer, yes. There are other people, but mostly I think what people are doing at this point, and I applaud it, is to look at features in the woods that nobody really knows what they are. And there are things like stone piles, There are long sort of dry stone alignments. I don't know if one can call them walls. In some cases, they are walls. There are also ditches in the marsh which align with the walls. And in the past, there was a real division between professional archaeologists and a certain group of amateurs who looked at all these things in the woods and said, well, they came up with various wild ideas about what the origins were. And I think originally they tended to think, well, perhaps it was, you know, Europeans coming over somehow, or monks from Europe, like the Mystery Hill, that kind of thing. And then later it was suggested, well, maybe they were made by Native Americans, and I think that's where people are at now, that they could have been made by Native Americans. But it's very difficult to pin down the evidence for that, of who actually made them. But at least people are recording where these things are now in the woods and across the fields, and there seems to be sometimes an alignment with solstice, summer solstice, winter solstice, either sunrise or sunset, and in some cases the northern constellations. Some interesting ethnohistorical material about that is coming up, you know, that, yes, you know, there were
calendrical kinds of
calendrical things, but also, you know, stories to do with, that have to do really with death and where do people go when they die, you know, the Milky Way is a path across the sky. Not necessarily a path, it can be a river too. There's also the what we call the Dipper, was in Native American thought to be a bear, and that, you know, has importance for, you know, Algonquin culture. So some of that, you know, is beginning to come out now. And I'm wondering, I mean, the cemetery site that I know about is facing north, which is unusual for a living site. So I don't think it's a living site. And maybe it's connected, you know, with the North Star, with the Polar Star and the bear. So, but, you know, these are just ideas that are kind of surfacing at this point. So...
The
stone piles
and stone walls, what kind of
ideas
those are the ideas you're referring to? They're constellation based?
Yes. And this, certainly it's known from Central America, you know, the Mayas were very much oriented that way, and because we're a long way from there, but you can kind of trace at least some connections all the way across by looking at the ethnohistory, which is, you know, the stories, the myths, and that have been recorded in different places. But it's a little bit sensitive because one doesn't want to ask a whole lot of questions to the Native Americans about this because it's their sacred traditions. And but they are becoming more active themselves now in trying to identify sacred sites and seeing that they're protected. So that's good, you know, that they are doing that. And archaeologists are trying to be sensitive about it, perhaps not always succeeding, but at least they're trying, which they haven't done in the past very often.
Fascinating.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad to have the opportunity to say this, because, you know, I don't know who's going to listen to it, but it at least says something about what I've been doing or where somebody else might be able to pick up the pieces for this. Or something else I perhaps should say is that the Massachusetts Historical Commission has a whole series of maps that show the sites, archaeological sites in different places. And so it's contributing to that information. And usually it's kept a little bit under wraps because they don't want to encourage people to go to these sites and remove the material. So, you know, it's a difficult thing because you want people to know about it, but you don't want people to destroy what's there. So, you know, it's
tricky,
yeah.
Does it relate to the mound culture at all, these piles of stones or not?
Well, yes. I mean, I think there's information from the 17th century from the Cape, you know, that they did. And yes, I think they say that they do still make piles of stones for, you know, if they feel there's something special about a particular area, you know, they will mark it in that way.
Today, yes.
Yeah.
I thought the mound cultures were burying in mounds, not so burying.
Burying. Yes, well, again, you know, this is a question mark, you know, were these marking burials? But I don't think the archaeologists have found any burials associated with them, you know. But, you know, it could be that the bones have disappeared in the meantime, too, also.
They do eventually, don't they?
Another thing that's just come out in here is that it looks like it's possible that the soil has become more acidic here as a result of European-style farming, and that it used to be more alkaline. So if that's the case, then the bones would disappear faster than they did in the past.
I never thought about that.
Yeah. So, you know, a lot of these things are still question marks, and what really are they? But it's kind of a race against time to preserve something like that when you don't quite know what it is, and so a developer wants to develop, and you don't have any good reason for saying, well, this pile of stones might be worth saving, you know.
It's not going to impress a lot of people.
People, no. So, you know, I think it's useful that people are plotting these things in the woods so that you're not just dealing with one pile of stones or a few piles of stones. You've got, there seems to be a connection between this and other features in the woods. Yeah.
That sounds so frustrating to have suspicions that there are important cultural significance under the soil, and yet someone's ready with the backhoe.
That's right, yeah.
Well, where public money is in the mix, there's a chance of doing surveys and evaluations that could postpone it at least. Huh?
And of course, time is money with any kind of digging, too, you know, or construction. But then sometimes occasionally, it looks like there's willful destruction, and that's very sad, I think, you know. People go in with a backhoe before it's identified because they think there's something there that's going to get in the way, you know. So that's another problem.
Here?
Not here in Concord, but I've heard of a site down on the Cape where this was the case, yeah. Anyway, it's difficult when you don't have anything on the surface that you can point to and say this is something. Or even if you do have something on the surface, but you're not sure what it really is, you know. So it's not like having a 17th century house that's, it's obvious that it's worth doing something with it. Yeah.
So there's a, say that like, if there's a 17th century house.
House, well, it's obvious to people that that's what it is, you know, and that it might be worth saving. But if you're looking at an open field and somebody tells you that there's something underneath it, you have to be able to, you know, say something about what that is that's under the ground and that it might be worth saving. Now, I should say that with this Sleepy Hollow extension area, that they did put, the town did put aluminum pins in the ground where the wigwam was and the fire pit, so that hopefully, you know, those won't get a burial put on top of them at some point. They should be preserved. I mean, it should be visible as something there. But then, you know, time goes by and people might find, not realize, you know, what these pins are for. But then at the same time, you know, if you put a, another idea was to put up a sign there saying, you know, there are Native American finds, but then that can lead to vandalism too. So it's really very tricky how to preserve these things. I was thinking about, a few years ago, I went back to my home village where I grew up, and I remembered that there was a very interesting tombstone there, which I wanted to go and take another look at, and I went and I could not find this, and I walked all around the church and I finally realized there was a whole bunch of old tombstones stacked up in a pile behind the church, and I suddenly realized that what they're doing now is burying people, you know, putting fresh burials in on top of where the old burials were. So you know, you've got burials now layered in one place. at least in this country, you don't have to worry about shortage of space to the same extent, although I'm in favor of, you know, cremations and not taking up a lot of room.
Well, I bet that really made you scratch your head.
Yeah.
Just to not find that tombstone where you
were
sure that it was.
Yeah. I think this was the lady who had 23 children and died at about the age of 40, you know. And, yeah. And her name was Patience. So.
And who's going to remember her story?
That's right, yeah.
You seem halfway calm about it all.
Well, it's either... either be calm or tear all your hair out.
Yes. Yeah.
Thank you very much. Is there anything that we should have asked you that we haven't? Is there anything else you want to cover?
I think I've said everything I had in mind. So, I think we're fine.
Well, we're going to send you a CD copy of this interview.
Okay.
And we're going to attach a song to the end of it. We won't tell you any more than that.
Okay.
Means you have to remember to do it.
Yeah.